All right, here's what you need to know about today. Are the French and the British providing Zelensky with nukes or the appearance of nukes so he can better negotiate with the Russians and the Americans? President Trump delivers his State of the Union speech to Congress. Great show, perhaps. Substance? You decide. And the China-Japan war of words continues. The latest on the comments that were made right here on the Sanchez Effect. Let's do this. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. There are some things that the President of the United States does well. Reading is not one of them. And you know when it's really obvious? When he has to read a speech, like the one he had to read last night, the State of the Union. I mean, there he was with, like, squinty eyes and a weird slouch as if uncomfortably trying to find the words in the teleprompter. He seemed to be agonizing over it, like it was some kind of new technology for him. You know, what he looked like to me when I was watching him, I was thinking to myself, he looks like a guy who is for the first time switching over from a typewriter to a MacBook Pro. Here's a taste.
And America's armed forces overwhelmed all defenses and utterly defeated an enemy, good fighters, to end the reign of outlaw dictator Nicolas Maduro and bring him to face American justice. And this was an absolutely colossal victory for the security of the United States, and it also opens up a bright new beginning for the people of Venezuela. We're working closely with the new president of Venezuela, Delcy Rodriguez, to unleash extraordinary economic gains for both of our countries and to bring new hope to those who have suffered so terribly. They really did suffer. With us tonight is Alejandro Gonzalez. She grew up in a tight-knit Venezuelan family and was especially close to her beloved Uncle Enrique.
I want to be fair. I think Mr. Trump is better when he's speaking impromptu than when he's trying to read something that somebody wrote for him. And there's something else he does that is perhaps better than anybody else who ever came before him or possibly anybody who will ever come after him. His ability to brag openly and loudly, taking credit for any and all wins, even if the wins are somewhat dubious, or even if it's somebody else's work. It's epic.
Our country is winning again. In fact, we're winning so much that we really don't know what to do about it. People are asking me, please, 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 Mr. President, we're winning too much. We can't take it anymore. We're not used to winning in our country. Until you came along, we're just always losing, but now we're winning too much. And I say, no, 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 you're going to win again. You're going to win big. You're going to win bigger than ever. And to prove that point, here with us tonight is a group of winners who just made the entire nation proud. The men's gold medal Olympic hockey team. Come on in.
It's a great moment. I mean, the U.S. hockey team is really good. But I have to ask, how good would they have been had they had to face off with other teams that are just as good? Fair question, right? We're never going to know the answer to that question because teams like Russia and Belarus, they were kept out. They're not allowed to compete in the Olympics. You know what else is a fair question? Why not? Why couldn't they compete? Because of the war in Ukraine? So then let me ask you this question. Was the U.S., was the UK, were the Germans not allowed to compete in the Olympics after they invaded Iraq, bombed Belgrade, attacked Syria, destroyed Libya? Just asking. And if it's worth asking about those endeavors, maybe it's time we ask the same about Iran. And here's the president last night describing that scenario.
For decades, it had been the policy of the United States never to allow Iran to obtain a nuclear weapon. We are in negotiations with them. They want to make a deal, but we haven't heard those secret words. We will never have a nuclear weapon.
Mr. Trump is saying that they have said that they're not going to agree to not having a nuclear weapon, but I got to tell you, that is not true. That is not true. Iran has said exactly that. It's already said that. It's over and over and over again they have said that. Just like Iraq once said, we don't have WMDs. Nobody listened. The citizens of the former Yugoslavia said, we need diplomacy, not bombs. Nobody listened. Bombs were dropped anyway. In fact, in the case of Iran, I went there myself. I went there because I wanted to ask the questions of these guys there, right? So I pressed the foreign minister, Arachi, on this very subject. I said, are you willing to not have nuclear weapons, and what will your threshold be? Give me the exact number. He did. Here it is.
I know that it is achievable. We can come to a better deal than before, and we are able to ensure that there is no nuclear weapon. This is the main concern of those who have concern. Nuclear weapons. No nuclear weapon, we can guarantee.
There's something else President Trump deserves credit for, which, interestingly enough, he underplayed last night when I was watching his State of the Union speech. Perhaps because, I'll tell you, he underplayed it, I think, because he's afraid of the neocons who started all of those wars that I just mentioned a little while ago. And what I'm talking about here is Ukraine. He deserves credit for being the first person to openly question Volodymyr Zelensky's honesty, his competence, his leadership skills. And since then, others in Europe have jumped on the Trump bandwagon, or Zelensky bandwagon, or whatever you want to call it, the Zelensky-Trump bandwagon, maybe. Countries like Slovakia, the Czech Republic, Hungary, all of a sudden, are unleashing a flurry of attacks. And they're creating what seems like a legitimate rift in the EU, in NATO, to stop the elite Europeans from funding the war against Russia. Listen to a guy that I recently sat down with. This is the foreign minister, Peter Szijjártó. I found him to be a reasonable and a smart guy, by the way. Here he is within the last 48 hours answering questions from reporters on this subject.
The problem is that the Ukrainian state hates Hungary, and the Ukrainian state carries out an anti-Hungarian political approach for the last 10 years. Ukraine behaves in a very hostile manner towards Hungary. Please ask the Ukrainians why they have stopped the oil deliveries to Hungary. Ask the Ukrainians why they put the security of energy supply of Hungary into risk, why they do not give back the rights to the Hungarian national community, why they endanger our energy security, and I'm very curious what their answer will be.
You know, I mentioned a little while ago that there's pressure to do a deal, right? Well, even Zelensky's now admitting that he's being pressured to do a deal and accept that, for example, the Donbass is a primarily Russian region that now belongs to Russia. And it's not the Russians who are telling Zelensky, you got to accept this deal. He says it's the Americans who are pressuring him right now to go along with this deal.
We have come closer to the territorial issue. Both the Americans and the Russians say that if you want the war to end tomorrow, get out of Donbass.
And now this, Russian intelligence has just put out a report saying that the West may arm Zelensky with nukes. Here's a headline. Take a look at this, right? According to reports released by the SVR, that's Russia's Foreign Intelligence Services, the French and the British want to give Zelensky a hand in his negotiations with Trump. Think about this. It makes sense, right? Think about it. As Trump has said himself to Zelensky, you don't have the cards. Remember when he said that to him? You don't have the cards, right? He's right. Do the math. Zelensky can't keep the lights on in his country. He has a huge corruption scandal. His military is being defeated. Russia is gaining ground. Many of his own legislature members have turned against him. More than half of his population has left the country and is somewhere in Europe. Who knows if they'll ever come back? And all of this has happened, right? While he's gotten more war funding than what was doled out for both the Vietnam and the Iraq wars combined. So he's negotiating. He's going to the negotiating table without leverage. He needs something to bring to the table, and certainly a nuclear weapon could do the trick, right? Even if it's only a dirty bomb, it could give him that power, that leverage over the Americans and the Russians. Now, to be fair, the French and the British and their respective very compliant media are calling this report complete hogwash, as they often do. But is it? Is it hogwash? Here's what the Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman, Maria Zakharova, released yesterday upon hearing the news.
According to the SVR, this is at the very least a dirty bomb. But the option of a full-fledged nuclear weapon, including its means of delivery, is also being seriously considered. London and Paris are already actively working to resolve relevant issues involving the covert transfer of European components, equipment, and technologies to Ukraine. Efforts are also focused on making Kyiv appear as if it developed these weapons itself. It should be obvious to all those involved in such reckless actions and to the international community as a whole that raising the issue in such a way is a categorically unacceptable and acutely escalatory step, fraught with undermining the international legal regime for the non-proliferation of nuclear weapons.
Now let's talk about China and Iran. You heard the news here on the Sanchez Effect yesterday as we reported that the Xi government is nearing a deal to supply Iran with supersonic missiles capable of taking out warships, maybe U.S. warships, with a specialized targeting system. One of China's most influential economists defended the move by his country right here, and it's making news all over the world. He said it right here on this show. Take a listen.
Both China and Iran are two fully independent countries with their sovereignty, and there is no international law which prohibits China and Iran to engage with each other in commercial transactions. It is clear to everyone in the world in decency that Iran is not threatening the United States with war or military confrontation. It is just the opposite. So how can you say, now that Iran is being threatened with war or military confrontation by the United States, therefore you should not export missiles to Iran? It's just the opposite. The United States should stop threatening Iran with war and engage with Iran in peace rather than in such military jingoism.
Those are strong words, but then Gao went even further with stronger words. When I asked him about Japan's growing militarization and the Japanese Prime Minister Takaichi's provocative anti-China rhetoric, even saying if China goes into Taiwan, Japan will attack China or something of the sort, well, to that, Gao said this. Take a listen.
Japan unconditionally surrendered, and there are terms for Japan never to constitute another military threat against China. Otherwise, they will be in breach of their unconditional surrender terms, and China, being a victor nation, has the absolute full right to strike at Japan to prevent the rise of Japanese militarism or neo-Japanese fascism, period. Should anyone really expect that China should allow the re-rise of Japanese militarism and neo-Japanese fascism? No way. Prime Minister Takashiki, wake up from your fantasy. You should never be allowed to rearm yourself to constitute another threat to China or to Russia or to Korea, for example, or to the United States, because we all need to remember Pearl Harbor. Never forget Pearl Harbor.
At one point, he even said, we will annihilate them. Victor Gao is he's a very smart man, former investment banker with Morgan Stanley. I got to know him while I was covering China. He doesn't speak for the government of China, to be clear. His comments certainly do reflect, though, Beijing's strategic messaging these days, if not its official state doctrine. There has been no official response as of yet from Japan or Washington that we've seen. But U.S. officials are continuing to point to their relationship with Japan as one of strength, while they continue to refer to China as dishonest and dangerous, especially when it comes to its handling of Taiwan. Stay tuned for more on this. Okay, joining us now to talk about Chinese missiles and all the other aspects of what might soon become a war between the United States and Iran, we hope not, are Sergeant Tom Norton. Sergeant Norton is a state senator from the beautiful state of Michigan, where my son is right now, by the way. Go Remington. He's also a veteran of the war in Afghanistan, and he's run an America First candidacy for Congress. Also joining us is Mohammad Mirandi, a very popular professor at Tehran University with very American ties. He's kind of a de facto spokesperson for the Iranian government. I'm not saying you're a spokesperson. I'm saying some in the media consider you that, just in case. So thank you, gentlemen, for joining us. Professor Mirandi, let me begin with you. Given where we are right now, are you convinced, as I said earlier, that the Iranian government has assured the Trump administration and anybody else who will listen that they're not interested in having nuclear weapons?
Yes, definitely. And the Iran has had signed a nuclear deal in 2015, where the most intrusive inspections ever carried out by the International Atomic Energy Agency were carried out for years. And they admitted that there is no sign that Iran ever had a military ambition with its nuclear program. There was no evidence of it. Mm. They at times raised certain suspicions, but they never found any real evidence. And even U.S. intelligence admits that post-2003, the Iranians never pursued a nuclear weapon. The IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, actually does not have any evidence from before 2003, and they are the ones who've been on the ground. In fact, the facilities that the United States and the Israeli regime bombed were all facilities where the IAEA has cameras, where their experts and their officials would visit constantly. They're all known entities. There's nothing secret about them. But the United States uses the nuclear program as a tool to attack Iran. If it's not, because the sanctions and the threats against Iran began far before the issue of the nuclear program, whether it was terrorism or human rights or anything else, the United States has had hostility towards Iran for decades.
But let's stop there, because you've made your point, and I think you made it quite clearly that it doesn't seem to be a whole lot of prima facie evidence indicating that Iran is or has had weapons of has had nuclear weapons. So, Sergeant Norton, to you then. What would be your case for being able to prove to the world that Iran needs to be attacked because they're doing the opposite of what Professor Mirandi just said?
Well, if you listen to the Iranian government, they'd also tell you they weren't supplying Afghanistan. And what they would do is they'd have the Pashtun cross into their border, supply them, or fighting in Afghanistan in the war on terror. So this is a nation that says one thing and has been caught doing others. And there's pictures of that you can find of the Iranian military would even drive into Afghanistan, hand it to the Pashtun because we couldn't engage them because we didn't have an official action of conflict. So,
what does that have to do with the question at hand, though? Let's stick to what I asked. The question is, what evidence can you present? He just presented a whole lot of evidence about the fact that, you know, even the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is saying, no, we haven't found anything. What do you have to prove otherwise?
Well, evidence that's out there is Pakistan developed nuclear weapons without people knowing it. North Korea got it. Every nation that is developing a nuclear warhead is going to do it in secret, period. That's what they're going to do. They're not going to broadcast to the world that we're going to build a nuclear warhead. And also the Ayatollah, they are the one group that, once they got a nuclear warhead, would be very willing to use it on their enemies or anywhere on the planet. They would, if they could mount it on a missile.
So it sounds like you don't have evidence. Sounds like you're giving me nothing. You're telling me that the Ayatollah is a bad guy. They did this. The North Koreans did this. The Pakistan did that. But again, my question, let me give you one more chance. What evidence do you have that Iran has or has had nuclear weapons? If you don't have it, just say it. We'll move on to the next question. It's okay.
Well, they've tried to develop actual nuclear energy. Nuclear energy is always used as a lead to get a nuclear bomb.
But nuclear energy, you need 90% enrichment of uranium to get a nuclear bomb. Right now, Iran is somewhere between 3.6 and 4. They're a hell of a long way away, man.
There is high schoolers that could probably build a dirty bomb at this point off the internet. So if they could get enriched uranium. Iran can mine uranium. It's a natural element in their mountains.
I get the feeling that in many ways, as an American, I don't believe this is being done on my behalf. It worries me that a lot of politicians and people in the media are making arguments just like they made about the war in Iraq, which is complete bullcrap, and other wars that we've fought, that we need to do things that aren't necessarily going to benefit my life or my wife's life or my kid's life or my grandchildren's life. Does that bother you a little bit?
Iran was actually overthrown in 1979 by the CIA and Jimmy Carter. What bothers me is the hundreds of thousands of people that have been killed by that government that were Jews, Christians, and their own citizens that they have killed, that the world knows they've killed. And the United States has a moral duty and an obligation to correct that. Raza Pavini was the only reason he was taken out was because the United States was upset that he was going to form a separate oil organization, separate from OPEC. They took him out and they funded $300 million for Ayatollah Khomeini, put him in power. So it's a moral obligation to the world to remove somebody that would kill his own people, threaten Israel, has threatened the United States in the past, to have them removed for the general security of it.
So let me get this straight then, and I'll toss this to Professor Morandi. His argument is that the United States has a moral obligation to punish Iran for whatever Iran may have done in the past to its own people. Do you buy that argument, Professor?
Well, first of all, the culprit is the United States, not the Iranian government. The United States imposed the Shah on the Iranian people. The United States carried out a coup in 1953 and imposed this dictator and helped create the SAVAK, the dreaded secret police. In 1979, there was a revolution where people revolted against that regime. And as we speak, we have synagogues in Tehran. We have kosher restaurants in Tehran. We have many churches in Tehran. We have a very active Christian community. In fact, the Armenian community and the country of Armenia clings to Iran because it feels threatened by its neighbors. So this narrative is, I don't know where it comes from in the United States, but the reality is the exact opposite. The only wars that the so-called Ayatollahs were involved in, I don't even know what that means, because the president is a heart surgeon, the Speaker of Parliament is a professor at my university, the head of the Supreme National Security Council is a professor in philosophy. But in any case, the only wars that we were involved in were two wars where we were attacked. Saddam Hussein, with Western support, invaded Iran. They gave him chemical weapons to use. I survived two chemical attacks. Germany was the most important country involved in the chemical program. But the United States and the Europeans never punished Saddam as long as he was using them against his own people and against the Iranians. So that aside, Iran did not, in response, produce chemical weapons. So while the United States supported Saddam, and then the United States supported Israel, the Israeli regime, in attacking and carrying out another war, Iran never engaged in any war. And to go to Afghanistan, in other words, Iran never initiated any, and Iran never produced chemical weapons in response to what the Europeans did and what the West did for Saddam.
Yeah.
With regards to Afghanistan, the problem, what was the problem in Afghanistan? There was no Carter coup in Iran. What Carter actually did was in Afghanistan with Brzezinski. They began supporting the so-called Mujahideen to get Russia, the Soviet Union, to invade Afghanistan, to create a Vietnam for the Soviet Union. So what Carter did was that he created, and subsequent presidents helped create, fanaticism and al-Qaeda in Afghanistan in order to create a Vietnam for, in other words, they sacrificed the country for their own interests.
The
result ultimately was blowback in 9/11, which resulted in the United States invading the country, occupying it for two decades. And obviously, people do not like occupation, and they resist.
So what do you buy that argument, Sergeant? I mean, the fact of the matter, and what Professor is saying is, the United States has put more on Iran than Iran has ever put on the United States. In other words, when did Iran attack the United States? When did Iran, other than sloganeering, threaten the United States or kill an American in the United States or bomb the United States? Is there a record of that?
Yes, the real problem is that the United States goes and bombs and occupies countries, whether it's Lebanon, whether it's Iraq, whether it's Afghanistan, and then expects everyone to accept their occupation. And when people resist, they go and blame Iran. Quit the occupation. Stop bombing countries.
But go ahead. Go ahead, Sergeant.
Afghanistan. So that's not a fallacy. That's fact. Number two, the 1953 revolution was actually by the United Kingdom when they put back in the Razapavini. Actually, simple search. And I know Tehran and Russia like to, you know, restrict the internet for searches, but you can get online and find basic declassified information of the revolution being funded by the CIA and Jimmy Carter. I know they like to whitewash those types of things. And the other part—
Which revolution?
Well, and you don't even have time to count votes. They declare a winner within 5 minutes of an election. That's not an election. That's just a pre-stamp.
Which revolution? Wait, I'm just asking. I'm sorry. You said that there was a revolution funded by Jimmy Carter?
Revolution for the Ayatollah in the late 1970s. He was in France, and the United States helped do that in order to remove this separate OPEC organization that the Razapavini was actually going out to found. You can get on there and actually find it.
Hold on. Let me offer my version of history. Mohammad Mossadegh was a very popular man in Iran in 1953. He had essentially won governance through the people and an election. And the first thing he wanted to do was give the oil of the country back to the people because it was controlled by the United States. And you're absolutely right, mostly the British. When he decided to do that was when he was couped by the West, removed, and they put in Pahlavi, who became the Shah. That's the story as I know it. What did I get wrong?
The family came, it was removed and put back in. But the other part was they were looking at disassociating with Russia back in 1953. So, I mean, we're talking about the history of that part of it. But the other part is Iran actually supplied terrorism. When 9/11 happened, the United States should not have invaded Iraq. I am not a person that actually supported the concept of invading Iraq. Going to Afghanistan, absolutely. But Iran was one of the primary suppliers of it. The countries that were responsible for 9/11 at that point, for the funding of terrorism, was the Iranian government and actually part of the Saudis. What we should have done is put an oil embargo on Saudi Arabia at that time and actually pumped our own oil. Should have at that point went after Iran and Afghanistan.
The only flaw in your argument is that the Iranians and the Saudis were at the time not exactly the best of friends. In fact, they were on opposite sides of the spectrum. Why would those two parties?
They're in a de facto Cold War, but they do actually sit there. At that point in time, we're both funding a terrorist organization independently and together. The terrorist organization didn't supply to just one government. They were funded by multiple.
So you're saying, so just for the record, to set the record right, make sure we understand you, you're saying Iran was responsible for the blowing up of the Twin Towers on 9/11?
One of multiple nations that were culprits.
Okay, back to you, Professor Mirandi. What sayeth you about that?
Well, yeah, this is, of course, from A to Z nonsense, that Prime Minister Mossadegh was overthrown illegitimately by the United States. It was Operation Ajax.
Yes.
And the United States installed a dictator.
Yes.
And in 1979, there was a public revolution. Everyone knows that. There were millions of people on the streets across the country. And you came to Iran just recently and you saw people rallying on the day of the revolution, commemorating for the revolution. Yes. Millions. No one can hide that. But to say that Iran was behind 9/11 or had anything to do with it, Al-Qaeda was a creation of the United States and its allies. Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan was blowback. Even Hillary Clinton admitted that. The United States was deeply involved in creating these groups. The Takfiri and extremist groups in Afghanistan, their first textbooks to young people, mm-hmm, to radicalize them, extremists, were printed in the United States. Nebraska Omaha University printed those books that were sent to the borders of Afghanistan and Pakistan to create religious hatred and to direct it at the Soviet Union and later on others. But if we want to talk about 9/11, obviously Iran was not involved. But increasingly, a lot of information is coming out about so-called allies of the United States knowing beforehand what happened on 9/11. I saw parts of Tucker Carlson's documentary on 9/11, and we all know where the finger can be pointed at. That's Tel Aviv.
Yeah. Let me ask you both a question. Do you think, Sergeant, that much of what we do in the Middle East, Iraq, Syria, Libya, Lebanon, now Iran, if we bomb Iran, is coming to us as a mandate from Tel Aviv, that this is what Israel wants, and Israel usually gets what it wants when it comes to wars, and they don't fight them, we fight them for them, and we pay for them, and we then give money to Israel on top of that. Should I be bothered by that as an American? Should you?
Israel could defend itself every day of the week, and it doesn't need the United States. I think a lot of these countries in the Middle East probably should be blessed that the United States does hold back Israel. Because when Israel's been attacked, they warned some of the other ones. And yes, Israel has done preemptive defense assaults, but they usually kick the living crap, excuse my language, out of these Middle Eastern countries.
Then why did the United States fight the war in Iraq? Where was Israel in the war in Iraq? Where were they?
Israel? Iraq?
Yeah. The Iraq was fought at the behest of Israel, but it wasn't fought by Israel, is the argument I'm making. And I'll say the same thing about Syria and Libya and, to a certain extent, Afghanistan.
Afghanistan is a country that was just drawn on a map because it was tribal. So, I mean, Afghanistan's never been a real nation.
As Rumsfeld said, remove Afghanistan because it's just a bunch of rocks. So let's talk about the other ones. We know that Netanyahu and the Israelis are on the record saying they wanted those countries eliminated, attacked, changed. The U.S. went in and did it. But Israel didn't do it. Our soldiers died. My money paid for it. Your money paid for it. Why, I'm asking? Are you comfortable with that?
Well, Iraq, I was never comfortable with.
Okay.
That, I stated earlier, but you take somebody like, you take countries like Syria that just went through a civil war. The United States had minimal resources there. Russia sent troops there to fight it as well. So, I mean, the war in Iraq, the other part is that has slowly became a nation. Iraq needed the war after the United States left to stabilize themselves to become an independent country in their self-identity. They have actual elections now, and they're becoming a much more stable nation.
But listen to what you're saying. But listen to what you're saying. You're saying Iraq was bad, but Iran is going to be good? Tell me what the difference
Iran
is.
Needs to come become Persia again, not Iran, and it needs to be restored to the Persian people.
So wait. Okay, but that's your opinion. What I want to know is you make the argument that you believe now, in hindsight, as do most Americans, by the way, credit to you, props to you, that Iraq was bullcrap. It was a made-up story, and we shouldn't have fought that war, and it was wrong.
I wrote a college paper in 2002 that called it bullshit, so I mean...
Good for you. Yeah, but now you're arguing that if we do the same thing in Iran, it will be okay. Is that what I hear you saying? And tell me, where's the distinction and the difference?
Why to these terrorist groups in the Middle East while we fought the war on terrorism. So I absolutely believe Iran is a threat. I've seen the equipment.
A threat to whom? A threat to whom? To America?
I know where they...
To America? How?
They pushed them up and through Afghanistan, and they also supplied them across into Iraq when we were in Iraq.
I'm trying to understand you. You're saying that you know because you...
The state supply of terrorism during the war on terror was equipment shoved out of Iran into Afghanistan and into Iraq.
So
how would we compensate Iranian equipment if Iran wasn't shipping it?
But let's suppose your argument is correct, for the sake of argument. And I'm not going to sit here and try and tell you which piece of hardware came from
where. Find some pictures somewhere on
phones. I'm taking you at your word. But I'm saying, let us suppose that 10 years ago, Iran may have been responsible for some equipment that was used by terrorists in Syria or here or there. I could argue that there are countries all over the world that we could tie certain pieces of hardware that were then used by either drug traffickers or this or that, including our own country, because I know what we did in Latin America. So you're arguing that because of that, we should now bomb Iran. That's the argument?
The argument for bombing is Iran is because they do have a religious theology that's running it, and they do persecute their people. There have been people killed. You've seen it on news agencies around the world. There is more Iranians that sit there and talk about this after they leave Iran. Why would
people
Iranians
leave every country? People who leave every country, sir, talk bad about their countries.
That's are these millions of Iranians, once they have freedom of speech, making this up? Are those millions of Iranians that have fled
and,
the country?
And people from every country. There's people in China who want us to attack China. There's people in Miami that want us to attack Cuba. There's people in Tampa who want us to attack Venezuela. There's people in Atlanta who want us to attack Argentina. People from all over the world go to different countries and then say how much they hate their countries and ask the country where they are to attack and kill the people of their country. That's the most common thing in the world. It's a species argument. Back to you, Professor, the argument that he makes, though, about the fact that your country, Iran, export terrorism, there is some validity to that, is there not?
No, it's the exact opposite. The United States supports terrorist groups in Iran, like the MEK, which is very well known. The MEK also fought for Saddam Hussein against our own country. That's just one of the groups. And let me go over a couple of things very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
One is in Afghanistan, the United States created that mess. In fact, contrary to what your guest says, Afghanistan was doing pretty well before the Soviet Union invaded compared to countries across. Yes, you can go and look at the statistics and the numbers. Thank God there's AI now. It went downhill very fast due to that dirty war. And as I said, Brzezinski gloated about convincing Jimmy Carter to push for this dirty war. It's not some conspiracy. This is an interview that he himself carried out before he died.
Yeah, yeah.
Go
ahead. Finish your point. I'm sorry.
With regards to terrorists in the region, if you're talking about Al-Qaeda, we know that it was created in Afghanistan. We know that the West used Al-Qaeda in Syria. How do we know that? Because Jake Sullivan, who was the U.S. president's national security advisor, when he was in the State Department, he wrote an email to Hillary Clinton on February the 12th, 2012, stating that in Syria, Al-Qaeda is on our side. And also, we have a document produced by the Defense Intelligence Agency of the United States in 2012, that U.S. allies in the region were creating a Salafist entity between Syria and Iraq to isolate Syria. And later in an interview, the head at that time of the Defense Intelligence Agency, General Michael Flynn, said that it was U.S. policy to support its allies in the region to create that Salafist entity. Who was that Salafist entity? It was ISIS.
Yeah.
So the United States was working with ISIS. It was working with Al-Qaeda. It supports terrorist groups in Iran. Yet the United States is always the victim. And when you talk about Iranian diaspora, there are many thousands of Iranians in the diaspora that are on the payroll. 4,000 of them. 4,000, almost 4,000, roughly 4,000.
Payroll for what? What payroll?
In Albania, they have just one camp where there are almost 4,000 people who are trolls. They're online trolls. They live in that camp, the Mujahideen Khalq. Everyone knows it.
Who pays them?
Anyone can look at
CIA?
Exactly. Exactly. I don't think the taxpayers in Iran pay for it. The taxpayers in the United States pay for it. It pays for them and the hundreds of TV channels and websites and the organizations on the border, the terrorist organizations in Iraq, in northern Iraq, alongside the Iranian border, and, of course, in Pakistan. So it's the United States is constantly threatening Iran. It is constantly attacking Iran. It supports countries that have zero elections, not even fake elections. and like Saudi Arabia or all other countries, simply because they're allied to the United States.
Let me show you something. I want to show you a video now of a man who wants the United States to attack Iran, and probably somewhat salivates over the idea of the United States being in a war with Iran. Here is Prime Minister Netanyahu.
I appreciate the efforts that President Trump is making to ensure that those threats against both our countries do not reappear. We have never had a greater friend in the White House than President Donald J. Trump. The truth is that Israel is not a burden to America. Israel is a strategic asset to America, as the American National Security Council itself says.
I feel bad asking you this question and putting you on the spot because I know you're running for office and you have run for office, and it's impossible to run for office in the United States and criticize Israel because there's no way in hell you'll ever get elected. But I'm going to ask you anyway. Do you believe that Bibi Netanyahu's intentions are for the benefit of the United States or simply for his own and for Israel's?
Well, Benjamin Netanyahu represents Israel, and every interest that he puts first is Israel's interest first. That is going to be the point of being the leader of a nation. Donald Trump puts the United States first.
Wait, let me stop you there. You said Donald Trump puts the interests of the United States first. Recently, it has seemed to me that Donald Trump or his administration has been much more interested in the interest of Israel than it has been the interest of the United States. Call me crazy, but I see lots of signs of this.
Well, you look at what happened in just taking out Venezuela. The United States has a huge immigration problem, and part of it is because Venezuela has become, you know, a socialist nation and bankrupt. By taking out the leader so that their economy starts to recover, that's where the United States is going to benefit, is by South America's economy growing. That's actually how you start to address illegal immigration in the United States, is increasing the economies of those nations.
But
I don't see how Venezuela benefits Israel.
Hold on. Since you went there, and I didn't ask you about that, let me give you a counterargument. Under Hugo Chavez, socialist, communist, greenie, whatever the hell you want to call him, I know some people get into labels, I don't. The poverty level in that country, because of what he was able to do to somewhat nationalize the oil interest that he feels were being controlled by outside forces for many years, the poverty level went from like 67 to something like 27. He actually increased the economy. He increased the GDP. He lowered poverty. The United States went in with sanctions. They were joined by the UK and other forces in Europe. And they started destroying the economy. They started doing terrorist act on oil plants, et cetera, et cetera. They made it so nobody in the world would touch the gas or the oil that was coming out of Venezuela. They destroyed the economy and therefore made the people of Venezuela flee to the United States. And now you tell me you're mad that the people from there went to the United States. Can you really have it both ways? Can you destroy the government of a country and then get mad that the people leave? I mean, is that fair?
Well, we're stabilizing it. We're making their economies better so that you don't have as many immigrants.
But you're ruining the economy. How can you make piss on something and then say, I'm watering the grass? But to be fair, I'm getting a little uncomfortable with this conversation, but listen to what I just said. The United States destroyed the economy of Venezuela and now says they want to fix it and is complaining about the people who left the crippled economy. That's a foolhardy argument, man.
Well, you have to go through and actually, if you're going to lower immigration, you have to fix the economies there. So ways that you fix it, restabilize countries and fix mistakes that the United States has made, which they're doing by removing Maduro. They're fixing a mistake, also caused by a Democrat president, just like Iran, caused by a Democrat president. Both times, and just like the cartels, taking out cartels, stabilize Central America, also help reduce illegal immigration. And the cartels, America's drug problem, is part of our immigration problem as well. It's not a foolhardy argument. You have to correct the mistakes of Democrats at some point, and that's where Donald Trump's really fixing this.
So all the things the Americans did that was, in your opinion, wrong were done by Democrats. The good stuff is done by
Republicans. With the exception of George W. Bush.
You know, I don't know if that's not a species argument. I'll go back to you, Professor, your comment after hearing that.
Well, you know, in the case of Venezuela, the United States put its boot on the people, on the necks of the people of Venezuela, tried to strangle them and say, look, your economy doesn't work. I think that shows who the real culprit is and where the real evil is coming from. Mm. When the United States supports ISIS and Al-Qaeda, it shows where the evil is coming from. Mm. When the United States and the Europeans give Saddam Hussein chemical weapons to use against people like me, many did not survive. Many are slowly dying as we speak. They die slowly over decades. They never apologize. They gave those chemical weapons. And then in the name of those chemical weapons that they gave to him to use, and they gave him the political cover and the military intelligence to use them, then they go invade the country and destroy it.
Do you?
In Afghanistan.
Go ahead.
In Afghanistan, they create the extremism. They create the extremism, and then they have blowback, and then they go invade the country, and then they want to blame Iran or Saudi Arabia. The fact is that the United States is an empire. Regardless of how terrible empires are and how ultimately they will collapse, in our part of the world, the main reason why the United States is so despised by so many people in countries that are allied to the United States, in all these dictatorships that are allied to the United States, is because the United States supports ethno-supremacism in Palestine. It supports a genocide in Palestine. It is constantly waging wars and dirty wars on behalf of the Israeli regime. If there was no Israeli regime, if there was no apartheid, if people were living as equal human beings, most were not Amalek, and they were all considered equal human beings, there would be no problem between Iran or anyone else in this region with the United States, whether it wants to behave as an empire or not. They would have normal relations, just like Iran has normal relations with Brazil. It has normal relations with Russia, with India, with China, with Pakistan, with South Africa. But the United States behaves as an empire, and also it does anything and everything that an ethno-supremacist genocidal regime wants it to do in West Asia and North Africa.
You know what
and
I found? But I got to tell you something, Professor. I went to your country recently. I spent a week there. You know what people in your country are fascinated by? America. I found I found a complete pro-America, I mean, position from a cultural standpoint, from a Hollywood standpoint, from a media, more than I have, actually. I can't stand Hollywood, but anyway.
In fact, Iranians have zero problem with the United States of America. It is the government of the United States. It has nothing to do with ordinary Americans. English in this country is the second language.
Yeah,
it is the language that we study at school.
And
it is the language that we study at university. Young Iranians who get scholarships are sent to Western countries often. Now, of course, other countries have been at it, but until, let's say, a decade ago, all of them were sent to the West to study and get a PhD.
I got a feeling most of the young people in your country, like the people in my country, think that the Ayatollah, just like the people in my country, think the presidents and the politicians are all a bunch of dumb boomers, that they kind of look at them like, okay, whatever, you know. Most of the young ladies I saw in Iran look no different than the young ladies in the United States. Most of the young men had the same interest, were into loud cars and fast music and the whole nine yards. I didn't see any country that was a scary, fanatical, religious sect. I didn't see that. What was I missing, right? Am I wrong?
What I would say, Rick, is that in the celebrations that you saw on February the 11th,
yes,
where there were millions of people in Tehran,
yes,
and
yeah,
across the country, tens of millions, there were young people and old, and they were commemorating a revolution because they wanted to, and
correct,
that included young people.
Yeah, it was July 4th for your people. It was July 4th. It was like
exactly.
Independence Day. I totally get that. Can you make an argument for? I saw a lot, you know, Sergeant. I saw a lot of children when I was in Iran. Good kids. They look just like your kids, my grandkids. I'm old. why we should bomb and kill those people. Can you make me understand why I, as an American, should pay for and why my fellow members of the troops, people like you, your friends, should go there and kill them?
With modern technology, we can take out the leadership without any putting boots on the ground. We proved that in Venezuela. But, I mean, if you want to sit there and have a true statement to see how much a people love a government, what they should do is do what the United States did, give everybody the Second Amendment. Then you'll have a real statement on what these countries and what these people want.
So you think we should arm all the people of... You're saying we should do that all over the world? Just go around the world giving everybody guns, and whenever they get mad at their government, you can shoot them?
I think everywhere there's a dictatorship, if the United States really needs to change it, why not? Airdrop them. And then let the people sort their own government out for once.
Would you argue, though, that when... I'm going to give you a counter-argument to that. I would argue that in your country and mine, we don't have a true democracy either. They are picked by donors, and they give us two people to choose from who aren't necessarily the choice of the people. And that's often what we have to pick from, and it's usually not the best. And that's too often what happens. And all of the people who get to Congress and the Senate are bought for by huge donors who have the interest of big corporations and not the American people. And when those people get to Congress, they don't serve the interests of the American people. And by the way, while on that note, 80% of Americans say they do not want a war with Iran. But they might get it anyway, because their vote doesn't matter anymore, my argument. Counter that yourself, please. You say,
well, one of the things that I want to see done is political party removed from the ballot here in the United States. I think we shouldn't have it. George Washington warned about the forming of political parties as a huge problem. So did many of the founding fathers. If we remove political party from the ballot, that would actually cause bigger issues where the donors would have to really struggle to figure out which direction.
Yeah.
It would also make it have a lot more ideas come to the table.
But see, that's my point. And here's where I'm trying to find common ground between the three of us. We have our own problems in our country. We have a democracy that's broken in our country. We have elitists that control everything. We have billionaires running our politics, running our media. The average poor guy growing up in Kansas or in Lansing, Michigan, he doesn't have any power anymore. So before we go around telling the Iranians how to fix their damn problems, shouldn't we fix our own first? Shouldn't we make sure my son can buy a house, which he can't these days? Shouldn't we make sure inflation... do you hear what I'm saying? We want to bomb a country without fixing our own damn problems first.
I still take the statement that we're correcting a huge mistake that was made, and they do fund terrorists around the world. Whether they like to admit it or not, their government does. And do their general people know it? No. People are always the victims of a war from governments that sit there and fail them at some level. And the United States might be absolutely horrible and terrible, but it's
not.
Still one
it's
of the best
country.
Economies and the best opportunities on the planet. And there is no other place in this world where they can sit there and walk in the street and say, I would like to overthrow my government and not go to prison. This is one of the few nations on the planet that you can do that.
Until you criticize Israel or anything having to do with Israel.
And then you lose your job.
It happened to me. You lose your job and they tell you you can never work again. Trust me, it happens all the time. And I know plenty of people in the United States who've been hit with that. So you're right. You can criticize the United States, but you can't criticize the founder of the United States or the real hand that runs the United States. As strange as it sounds to say that, Professor Morandi.
Well, if Israel was funding the United States, then how are we funding their wars? That must not be the taxpayer now, so you can't make that argument.
It's an interesting situation that you just raised and a great question. Professor Morandi, I give you the last word.
Yeah, I think it's quite clear that the United States already provides weapons across the world, like in the case of ISIS and Al-Qaeda and the terrorists that have been active in Iran that have been slaughtering people throughout the decades in this country. It's very well documented. And even in the case of Afghanistan, the United States, it brought about this mess by giving weapons to people and to destroy Afghanistan because they wanted to get revenge for Vietnam. This is something that comes from the U.S. National Security Advisor, and it doesn't come from me. But ultimately, the problem is that the United States has been antagonizing Iran for well over four decades for two main reasons. One is because it's independent. And the second is because it opposes ethno-supremacism in Palestine. Mm. It's as clear as day. There's no other reason. The United States has great allies that are completely despotic. It supports terrorist organizations across the board, as I've pointed out. And the United States has no problem whatsoever when genocide is carried out, when children are slaughtered on a daily basis in Gaza, in Lebanon, or when people's land, as we speak, are being confiscated in the West Bank, and when they're protesting mm-hmm. about it, they get shot. Yeah. So the United States has a serious problem. And instead of trying to find a solution where, okay, we're going to bomb all these different countries, or we're going to give weapons to everyone who we don't like,
fair.
It should start thinking about first fixing its own country, retaking the country back from the Epstein class, and trying to build bridges with people from across the world.
Yeah, and I got to say, look, when I went to your country, Professor, I found a lot of problems that the government needs to fix. And I asked them about them. And I question how they dealt with the protests. And I question how they're going to deal with the suspects from the protests. And I question them in how they're handling their economy. Obviously, not so well. I know, sanctions. But still, so there are problems in Iran. There are problems in my country and the sergeant's country.
Just one point. When you came to Iran, your guest said that Iranians don't know what's going on. The Iranians have much more knowledge about what goes on in the United States than what Americans know about Iran.
Well, Americans
know very well what's being said. They know exactly what's going on in Iran in according to American narratives, because we have hundreds of Persian language TV channels being beamed into the country that are funded by the United States, and people can watch them at home every night.
Yeah, but there are security problems in Iran as well. And look, my point is, Iran is not a panacea. My country, the sergeant's country, is not a panacea. The issue is, fix your own problems and try and help them make the world a better place. And it seems to me like sometimes we want to step outside our own territory, and that's when I think we get ourselves in trouble. I'd like to see more of America's money being spent on Americans. That's my point. And I wish we could find a way to do that. And I hope that we can get someone like you, Sergeant, in politics so they can take care of the people of Lansing and not worry about the people in Tehran. But maybe I'm crazy. By the way, wonderful conversation. Really kind of you guys to take time. I know you have very, very busy lives, and I really thank you for joining us. Sergeant, thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate your time.
God bless.
And thank you, Professor.
Thank you, Rick.
Well, yesterday we had an interesting conversation as well, and we made news here on the Sanchez Effect when a Chinese advisor said that his country will annihilate Japan if they continue militarizing. Wow, talk about hot talk, right? And apparently many of you watched our debate with Pascal Lota from Japan, Victor Gao from China, and here's some of the comments. So we start with CFTN6153 saying, hundreds of years of humiliation. China will never forget that. Victor Gao talks facts. Bravo, she says. BJ1286 says, Pascal needs to move back and stay with neutrality studies. Dubuque Werke Katerega says, bravo, China. Bravo, Xi. Long live President Xi for standing with Iran. And then Sleepwatcher says, Rick, YouTube is weird. After all the years they censored you, now I found your channel again. Congratulations, I'm here. Antio Ochoa, 7131, says, Victor Gao should be the next FM, I guess, foreign minister of China. China urgently needs a man like him who has significant knowledge, is outspoken and not shy or unafraid. I am Hussein94 says, subscribe to the channel. First time watching you, Rick. Keep up the good work. And KP Wong says, Japanese atrocities in China from 1931 till 1945 must never be forgotten. If Japan tries to militarize again against China's, then China must pulverize Japan this time. Strong words. As usual, I want you to know that we appreciate your feedback. check out my page on YouTube. It's called Journalistically Speaking. You can also find us on X. You can find us on BitChute. Exciting times there. And Spotify. They're all coming to us. That's good news. I thank you for coming to us. And thank us, or thank you, for letting us into your homes. And we'll see you next time.